Welcome to Authorial Intentions, the latest in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. The series finally has a name, and perhaps sometime in the future we'll also have some theme music, but we continue with the same interview format we've used since the beginning. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Philip Ackerman Lieberman, assistant professor of Jewish studies and law and affiliated assistant professor of Islamic studies, about the recent book, A Jew's Best Friend, The Image of the Dog Throughout Jewish History, which was edited with Rakefit Zalashik. Phil, thanks for being willing to be part of this interview.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, Chris.
Jack Sasson, one of our Vanderbilt colleagues, sent out a posting about A Jew's Best Friend on his Agade list. And he told me that he'd received more reaction to that post than on most others. Rather than ask you to speculate about why that might be the case, although you certainly can if you'd like to, I wanted to ask a related question. What inspired you and your co-editor to put together a book about Jews and dogs? I'm interested in the personal factors, of course, but I'm also wondering, you know, what are some of the larger movements in the academy that might have played into the appearance of this book?
Yeah, the simple and rather humorous personal factor is that Rakefit and I were office mates when we were on the Darod Fellowship at NYU, so we were postdocs together, and I came into the office on Sundays periodically, and when I did, I would bring my dog, Caleb. And so it turns out that Rakefit was also a kind of a dog lover. She had her dog Santa for a number of years. We actually dedicated the book to Santa's memory and to Caleb, who, thank God, is still alive and kicking around at 12 and a half. Wow. So, you know, at the same time, across the hall from us was one of our more senior colleagues, Chassia Diner, who works on American Jewish history. And Chassia grew up in Wisconsin in a kind of traditional Jewish family and had this antipathy for dogs. So you have, like, right across the hall, you know, just a diametrically opposed attitude towards dogs. And we wanted to explore you know, what we had a kind of a gut feeling for, which is that in many traditional corners of the Jewish world, you have an antipathy towards dogs, and yet, you know, at the same time, you know, we see dogs, you know, entering the home life and becoming a core part of the Jewish world. You know, I was just in Israel, and I visited a friend of mine who's ordained as an Orthodox rabbi, go into his house, and, you know, lo and behold, he's got a dog. And I thought to myself, you know, what is this, a yid mit de hunt? You know, like, it's so weird to see it. And despite this, you know, we do have traditional Jews today that have dogs. But at the same time, you know, you can walk through Brooklyn, and you see someone walking a dog, and, you know, black hat Orthodox folks will cross the street. So, you know, we wanted to kind of look at this this tension that we saw in the Jewish world, and see where it was coming from, and you know where do those folks who are you know, kind of made squeamish by the dog and the image of the dog, where does that come from? And, you know, what about those folks who seem to overcome it? And, you know, as we see in the introduction, over the course of editing the book and putting together this collection of articles that cover all periods of Jewish history, we found actually that there was a kind of a consistent negative approach from the classical texts, right? The Bible, you know, has this kind of negative view of the dog, and yet there is evidence that we found throughout Jewish history of an intimate relationship between Jews and dogs. So that's still there today, and, you know, and that for us, I think, was incredibly interesting. Now, as for the kind of broader scholarly piece, I organized a panel a couple years ago at AJS, the Association for Jewish Studies, on Jews and animals. And, you know, for the American Academy right now, animal studies is occupying an increasingly important role as we, I think, you know, move from kind of subaltern history, I think, which, you know, a generation ago, you know, really wasn't a field, you know, women's history, black history, you know, history of minorities and so on, has really come into its own. And I think that the next frontier will be, you know, the kind of subaltern, that is to say, animals and so on. And so moving on to these other species, I think, may just be an effect of our expanded sense of our humanity. So again, this is certainly what came out of our Jews and Animals panel, which you know kind of made me think that maybe a Philip K. Dick's story, you know, do androids dream of electric sheep?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, is that really the next frontier too? You know, after right, first it's humans and all types of humans from all corners of all ethnicities and all corners of you know, the demographic and economic spectrum, you know, then moving on to animals. And eventually are we going to think about, you know, how we treat our machines? And of course, what Philip K. Dick is saying is as those machines get more and more complicated, they're going to develop emotions too, right? And we, and that's something that we thought about a lot when we wrote the introduction to Jew's Best Friend. You know, to what extent do dogs actually have the emotions that we impute to them, or, you know, do they have a much narrower kind of emotional spectrum, and we simply use them as a kind of a backboard for what's going on in our own, you know, emotional, you know, in our own emotional kind of life? You know, if you look at the cover of the book, you know, you see a Jew. I was going to say a Jew. It's a dog, you know, looking on the outskirts of the city at his own reflection in a river.
Right.
And so, you know, there, you know, of course, Jews were marginalized. You know, in you know, throughout history, in various cultures in which they found themselves, and so they were on the margins too. And so we have a dog looking at himself in the river. And you know, what I had in mind when I first saw this image was, you know, the Jew on the margins looking at himself in the river and seeing the dog. And so the dog is the other's other.
Right.
And that, for us, was what was most exciting about the whole topic of Jews and dogs.
Great. You've already talked about the introduction, and in the introduction, you and your co-editor make clear that this is, and you've just made clear that this is not just a book about how Jews relate to dogs as dogs. And you know, contributors like Joshua Schwartz, who talks about the Kufri dogs. Which he suggests, and this is a spoiler, perhaps, that they may actually be hedgehogs. you know, even the dogness of dogs isn't always obvious. Balak, the dog in Agnan's novel Only Yesterday, is a dog, but evidently more than a dog, or so argues Uri Cohen in his contribution. So, you know, play off all these books that are, what are you talking about when you talk about blah? What are you talking about when you talk about dogs?
Yeah, this is why the subtitle for the book is called The Image of the Dog Throughout Jewish History, because, you know, even though in my article I'm really talking about dogs qua dogs, right? What role do dogs play in the medieval Islamic world? You know, do we see them in the city? Do we see them in the country? Are they acting as guard dogs? Are they acting as some kind of producers? Or are they pets? Right? But, you know, what was most interesting to us in the book as a whole is the image of the dog and what the dog represented. And so if you're going to look at it in those terms, then the category of dog can be much broader than, you know, what we think of as, you know, the dog. And that's why, you know, when Josh Schwartz talks about, you know, the Kufri dog, it incorporates these other species, right, that that, you know, it's clear we're not talking just about dogs. But then, you know, when you get into to the Agnon story, or, you know, Tumultuous Shom, Only Yesterday, or into Yoram Kaniuk's Adam Resurrected, right, which was subsequently made with the film starring Jeffrey Goldblum, right? You know, there, you know, you see this line between humans and dogs being blurred, right? Humans are dogs. And by the way, you know, that's something that, you know, we see in the contemporary period in cinema and in literature, but you also see it in the medieval period in Ken Stowe's article, where he talks about the Jews being described as dogs. And he didn't only do it here, he did it in his own book from Stanford University Press, where he talks about, develops further this image of the Jew as dog.
Right.
So that, you know, where that line is really important. And for us, and we say this in the introduction, you know, that line between humans and dogs is much greater. This is going to sound crazy, but it's much grayer than we might think. Dogs were the first species to be domesticated before any plant species at all. You know, before humans were farming any kind of grain or planting any kind of trees, right? They were in partnership with dogs. Dogs were domesticated. And so, you know, psychologists today, when they think about, you know, what the closest kind of psychological characteristics are to humans, you know, we might think, look at primates, because they share so much, you know, kind of physiology, mm-hmm. right? But the fact of the matter is that relationship between humans and dogs has been so close for probably 10,000 years that they've started to look also at canine behavior as, maybe as a proxy for mm-hmm. For human behavior because of that kind of shared relationship over such a long period. So, again, for us, you know, exploring the Jew as dog, when does dog not really mean dog, when does dog mean human, you know, we're trying to look at the image of the dog, not necessarily, you know, dog as dog, right. As I do in my article, but, you know, they are much more expansive over the course of the whole book. And, you know, and here's another example that from Meir Edry's chapter on puppy skeletons discovered at Ashkelon in the land of Israel, you know, that dogs might have been a proxy for human sacrifice, that there might have been a cult involving sacrifice of puppies that, again, might have been a proxy for humans. And when we look in the Bible and see Abraham taking up his son to sacrifice him, you know, it's clear that in the ancient Near East, human sacrifice is... at least in some groups, we see this elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible as well, the order of the day. And so the idea that might be foisted onto that species that's closest to us, but not us,
right.
is really important. And again, you know, I return to the cover image, right? You got the dog, Jew, outside the city, you know, looking at himself. Right. So,
Similarly, I mean, there seems to be an attempt in the volume to differentiate among various types of Jews. For the question, and you kind of alluded to this already, are dogs a Jew's best friend? A view taken out of the Hebrew Bible might conclude, well, not so much. Rudolfina Menzel, who's described in Susan Kahn's piece as a pioneer in introducing dogs to Jews in pre-state and the state of Israel, would say, you know, why can't they be Jews' best friends? Some of this is due, of course, to the kinds of dogs we're talking about, but it also seems to have to do with, you know, which Jews are we talking about?
Yeah.
So what are some of the ways that the book explores varieties of Jewishness with regard to dogs?
Yeah, look, I think that, as I said before, we have explored in the last generation or couple generations the idea of subaltern history, and we have begun to look at the idea of history as not simply emerging from the top, right? You know, you look at, you know, when I get undergraduates at Vanderbilt, right, they, you know, overwhelmingly came from high schools where history for them meant political, military history, you know, documents for them meant, you know, classical sources or legal sources and so on. And, you know, one of the first questions I ask them is, so, you know, when you're driving on Route 65 and it says speed limit 70 miles an hour, that means that nobody drove faster than 70, right? You know, so, oh, really? You know, they begin to see that, you know, life and literature are intertwined, but they don't necessarily describe one another, right? So we in the book really wanted to look at these classical texts and see what they had to say and then try to tease out what life was really like. It's something that I do in my own work because I study documents from daily life. I study essentially people's trash and try to, from that trash, figure out, you know, what they ate, what their relationships looked like, what life looked like. You know, was if we looked at the classical texts, or you look at the Bible, you look at the Talmud, and in my case, not only Jewish literature, also Islamic literature, you know, you get the idea that the dog is really the other, and something that is, that is impure. In the Islamic world, of course, dog spit makes you impure, you can't pray, which is an important piece, you know, five times daily prayer, having dog spit is a real problem. But even having a dog in front of you while you're praying might nullify your prayer, right? So despite that, right, I have evidence that in the medieval Islamic city, there are dogs barking, right? So you'd think that, if this was really a problem for a community that was praying five times a day and, absolutely... careful about having dogs there, that we wouldn't be hearing barking, right? In the Jewish context, we have, Jewish tanners saying, look, I need dog droppings to prepare, leather for prayer items, for ritual items, right? So somehow this becomes an essential piece of Jewish practice, right? Despite the fact that, as you point out, right, the Hebrew Bible has a sort of a negative view in general towards the dog. So for us, I don't know that we're talking so much about groups of Jews here and, you know, here or there, although certainly, you know, I started out by talking about, you know, kind of ultra-Orthodox versus, you know, my friend who's kind of more moderate Orthodox guy who has the dog. Right. But I think, you know, what we're talking about here is literature versus life and how that tension plays out. Mm. And so, you know, I mean, that's part of why I think the book is interesting, not only to folks who love dogs, but it's interesting to people who are, you know, kind of want to think about Jewish history, you know, and or maybe, you know, history in general, how we think about it and what is important in thinking about history, right? Are those classical texts important, or do we want to try and get a fuller vision of what life was like?
Right.
So, you know, that's something that I think we really try to do. And, you know, because humans and dogs have had this long-standing relationship, sure, maybe the classical texts have been against it, right? And by the way, I'd expand this to how Jews themselves were thought about in the medieval city. You know, in medieval Europe, you know, you may see screeds against the Jews, but guess what? You know, there are undoubtedly neighborly relationships between individual Jews and individual Christians, right? So, you know, this is something that, I have to periodically rail against when my colleagues try to, you know, kind of fetishize a literary text and say, well, this is descriptive of what the relationship was like between Christians and Jews. Really, show me some actual evidence from daily life. Don't show me what someone wanted you to think. So I think we try to get at that at the book to you know, provide a fuller picture and maybe to vindicate an image that, you know, again, in the classical text was kind of vilified.
Okay. You mentioned your own contribution, which is called The Dog and the Mindset of the Jews of Medieval Islam. And that and some of the other essays in the book explore the ways in which Jewish reactions to dogs were conditioned by the environments, particularly the religious environments, but religious practices in those environments. So in what ways have Jews been influenced by how the dog has been perceived in these environments, and how have they absorbed or resisted these kinds of
influences? I think that this kind of brings me to think about a broader question. Is there any kind of essential Judaism? And I know that that Tony Stewart, who's chair of the religion department here, is spearheading a new project asking whether there is any kind of essential Islam, or if Islam is always structured by the context in which it finds itself.
Mm.
Well, if this is the case for Islam, right, which in many of those contexts represented the kind of majority, well, then how much more so is Judaism shaped by the context in which it finds itself, where the numbers are often very small? Right? In late antiquity and early medieval Europe, you know, the numbers of Jews, you know, in any location are very, very small. And even in the in medieval North Africa, the communities that I deal with, we're talking about, you know, a few hundred Jews here or there. And maybe in all of Egypt there could be 10,000 Jews. That would be huge, right? So, you know, what that means is we're talking about a drop in a much larger bucket, and therefore the waves that affect the water in that bucket are going to affect the Jews and shape that relationship. So that's one piece. Another piece is, and maybe, you know, with the founding of the modern state of Israel, that might be turned on its head because you have a community that represents the majority in many ways. And yet, despite that, the image of the dog in modern Israel is totally shaped by the Jewish historical experience in the diaspora. And I'd call to mind Rakefet's article on the Azit, the paratrooping dog series, because Azit is a German shepherd. You know, so don't think that when General Motagur wrote the book about the paratrooping dog that he wasn't thinking about the German shepherd as being used by the Nazis to ferret out Jews, right? And yet he turns the image on its head. And suddenly Azit is the dog who saves the Israeli soldiers, right, from you know, from their enemies there and trapped and so on. You can watch the movie if you want. It's pretty pretty enjoyable, you know, from the 1970s. And, you know, there's a scene in which the dogs are in a kind of a military row, and they call them out and tell each one to sit in sequence. And each one is a different breed, but the one that emerges as the most agile is the German Shepherd. So I think that, you know, Jewish life is all about context. And I think, you know, if you ask my colleagues in Jewish studies, that they would say the same thing, that the major question that we ask as Jewish studies scholars, which is probably different from Islamic studies and perhaps different from religion as a whole, is how has Jewish life and literature been shaped by its context? And so, you know, that's why we wanted to provide in the, you know, in the book, you know, not only a large you know, diachronic historical trajectory, but also, you know, to give, views from different places. You know, my article sits a little bit against Ken Stowe's article, because Ken's writing about medieval Europe. And, you know, so we're both writing about the medieval period, but by looking at different places, you see how the context shapes the relationship of Jews to dogs.
Ken Stowe, these are all perfect segues. Every one of your comments is a perfect segue to my next question. You know, Ken Stowe's essay, I mean, when I got to that essay, I was like, whoa, because it was so totally different from, to me, from, from the essays that came before. The essays that came before are, you know, mostly sort of historical, focus on Jewish attitudes towards dogs as dogs. And then you get Ken Stowe's essay, which is, you know, how Christians figure Jews as dogs. And it's just, you know, really kind of a disturbing, disturbing essay. But then you see it, you see this, you know, in, you see that the whole identification of Jews and dogs in other contributions, Iftah Baran's contribution on Adam Resurrected, which you mentioned, and then, as you just said, the Azit the Canine Paratrooper, you know, a dog as an Israeli, not a Jew exactly, but as an Israeli. So how, can you talk a little bit about the ways in which this identification takes place, and what kinds of effects it has? Because it doesn't seem like it's all what Ken Stowe is saying. I mean, there are Jews that are talking about it, and there are Christians that are talking about it, and probably other people.
I mean, Ken's article definitely, you know, is a kind of a, you know, a centerpiece for the book. That, you know, as you said, like in the, when we're dealing with, you know, the early period. Right, there definitely, you know, there's this tension between the classical texts, and then we try to look, as Meir Edry does, as I said, at, you know, kind of archaeology, or, you know, Josh Schwartz and Sophia Menashet try to look at classical texts, the Bible or the Talmud, and then try to say, well, what can we really read between the lines and figure out, which is what, you know, we do as classical scholars, right? It's what I tried to do too, but then, you know, then you have my article, which tries to look at some information from daily life. And then you get into Ken's article, which, yeah, turns the idea on its head. But then all the articles after that, as you move into the modern period, have something to do with not just the dog, qua dog, you know, in the city, out of the city, in the home, out of the home, but the kind of morphing of identities of humans and dogs. And I think particularly of Aubrey Glazer's piece, the you know, the second to last article, where he talks about you know, Jewish American rituals surrounding dogs, because there, you know, the dog is really part of the family,
right?
I mean, that's why you have to bring the dog into the family with an adoption ritual. You have to, you know, commemorate a dog's life with some kind of funeral ritual or something like that, a blessing for the animals, right? You know, these are, you know, ways that that line between humans and animals is really blurred. And, you know, I would imagine if, you know, if you asked Josh Schwartz, you know, would, you know, how would someone, how would a Jew living in antiquity, you know, kind of think about the acquisition of a dog, you know, and clearly the idea is that that dog is a possession that might have some kind of role, you know, in or out of the house. But, you know, as we in the contemporary period start thinking about humanity, as I said before, in a more expansive way, right, you know, those animals really become part of our households and part of what we think of as humanity as a whole. And so, you know, Ken, you know, that's why it's called the medieval period. It's kind of in the middle of it, right, that we're really, you know, we're really shifting. And as we move into the modern period, some of those boundaries have broken down, and you see it with Ken. So first it's, you know, Jews and dogs maybe competing, and then it's Jews as dogs, and then it's, you know, Jews and dogs together. Mm-hmm. You know, that there is that kind of overarching trajectory. So then again, you know, maybe the book isn't really about dogs at all, but it's about how how we think about, you know, humanity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And again, that's, I think we get that a little bit in the cover, which I'm proud of, because, you know, you have the dog looking at himself, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. We can't show the cover.
You can buy the book.
That's right, exactly.
Take a look at the
cover. And you'll see the cover. Mm. You mentioned Aubrey Glaser's essay, and I wanted to ask you about that. You know, we can't talk about every contribution, although we've touched on a lot of them. But as you're saying, Glaser talks about contemporary rituals for dogs, and as you said, you know, the dogs become, or pets, not just dogs, but become through these rituals part of a human family, ritually at least, if not, you know, beyond that. So these kinds of trends, as you're suggesting, have the possibility of challenging the distinctions humans often draw between ourselves and other animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the authors Glaser mentioned seem to be a little bit concerned about that kind of direction. How far do you see these trends going in Jewish communities, given the relationship, the fraught relationship? And to what degree do these trends move actually in the direction of anthropomorphizing the dogs, something that you and your co-editor raise as a possible concern in the production?
Look, you know, I mean, I look at my dog and, you know, I wonder, you know, what he's thinking. And I know what he's thinking, which is, you know, when are you going to give me a snack? You know, or when are you going to take me out or whatever, you know? And yet, you know, I imagine that he's thinking, how was your day? So that's totally natural. And, you know, I think that comes from, you know, just the human psyche, you know, that we project, whether it's onto other human beings or whether it's onto animals, you know, stuff that isn't necessarily there.
Right.
And so I think it's natural for us to do it. And as, you know, dogs have become, you know, close companions living in the home, it is totally natural for us to do that. You know, so you'd have to ask, you know, a biologist what's really going on in the dog's head.
Right.
But, you know, that human impulse to create ritual is, I think, independent of the biology piece, right? You know, that closeness, you know, I mean, why do you have to have a funeral for a fish, right? But how many people do you know? You know, they stand around the toilet, they say a few words, and they flush,
right?
You know, so, and maybe that's the next frontier, right? But, it's just natural. I mean, we're talking about mammals that, you know, many people sleep with, you know,
right.
And, you know, and you've heard of people who, you know, if they experience infertility or something like that, they, you know, they get a puppy, you know, as a way of dealing with the issue. You know,
right.
So dogs do occupy this tremendous emotional space for us. And so it's out of that the ritual piece comes, I think. Now, I think to some extent that Aubrey, who's not only a scholar but also a practicing rabbi, you know, that his article is important because you know, people could look to the article as a point of reference. In fact, one thing that he has that, you know, some of the other articles don't have, he's got an appendix where he goes through an actual ritual of blessing of the animals. Now, you know, surprisingly, Aubrey did not choose to include, like, an adoption ritual or a funeral ritual, right? Because, you know, I mean, I haven't been to a puppy adoption ritual, but, you know, I do have a friend who, when his dog died after, you know, more than 10 years, you know, they planted a tree in the backyard, they did some readings and so on, and, you know, and some other friends who have had kind of commemorative dinners and so on where they, you know, talk about the animal. And I think that, again, that comes from our natural you know, ritual need to deal with the emotional piece. And again, that's independent of whatever the dog experienced.
Right.
You know, we have that need to commemorate our you know, lost companion in this particular way. And so I do hope that that practitioners will look at Aubrey's article, will look at the appendix, and, you know, we'll cop it, you know, we'll steal it and start using that. I'm hoping that we'll do some launchings for the book, maybe in Nashville. One of my colleagues, a rabbinic colleague, said, you know, he's game for that. And then some friends have said they'll bring their horse. It's pretty remarkable to have a horse walking through the synagogue in Nashville. But, you know, some kind of blessing of the animals. And so that's interesting on a number of levels, right? What it says about our concept of humanity, what it says about the connections between Jews and the broader 20th century, 21st century American context, because of course it's the Franciscan blessing of the animals that really influences and creates this Jewish ritual too, right? And again, as Aubrey gets into, you know, our natural ritual need to commemorate these things has played out in the development of a number of rituals. Now, I talked before about the tension between the kind of classical text and daily life.
Right.
If you go on YouTube and you look for bark mitzvah, you'll find a bunch of people, right, celebrating the 13th birthday of their dog or their dog reaching maturity, whatever that means, or something like that, right? Are the rabbis presiding over these? No, of course the rabbis, you know, abhorred, eschew the very idea, right? Now, it's worth asking, and I think your question touched on that. Why is it that rabbis would find this abhorrent, right? Mm. And I think that, you know, you have a tension in the American Jewish community that, you know, the more progressive rabbinic establishment understands how ritual works and that as dogs have moved into the home, you know, want to honor that because, you know, they see ritual as a, you know, as a natural response to the kind of psychological complexities of life. Now, you have, you know, on the right, you know, the more conservative elements in the Jewish community that are attached to the textual tradition, right? And the textual tradition, you know, has, as we've said, you know, a number of points of discontinuity with animals. And so, you know, we have to kind of negotiate this space, you know, and the fact is that, you know, the traditional rabbinic establishment might be opposed to it, but some of their, you know, some of their constituents are, you know, going to have those dogs, and they're going to see how their, you know, their more progressive, you know, friends are dealing with them, and that will, I think, you know, leak in. And so, you know, while there are these poles, they're not poles, but there's more kind of a continuum.
A follow up on that, it's interesting because that particular article is focused on the American Jewish community.
Yeah,
I was wondering, what do you know? I mean, it's not fair to ask you necessarily since you didn't write the article, but do you know? I mean, are there similar kinds of attitudes towards towards these kinds of rituals in, say, Israel, or
right. So look, you know, I know that when I saw my friend Daniel, you know, and he had a dog, I was stunned.
Yeah.
Again, he's an Orthodox rabbi, and I know his folks never had a dog, as far as I knew. So, but you know, he's got six kids, and so probably, you know, that had something to do with it. I think that because, as I said before, Israel has a majority Jewish population, that the weight of that context is very different. You know, whereas in America, you know, I think that American Jews are as American as they are Jewish. And I think that Aubrey would say the same thing, that in Israel it's not the case, right? Folks come from a tradition, you know, those, you know, Arab Jews, many of them left Islamic lands in the, you know, with the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 or shortly thereafter, right? Those who came from Europe, many of them left in the wake of the Holocaust, right? And so, you know, those folks came from somewhere else and they create a kind of communal sense of Jewish life in Israel, where, of course, there are fissures and tensions there too. But I think that there isn't the same weight of context that there is outside. And that's why Aubrey wrote about the American Jewish community, because I think that's kind of the tip of the spear where there is the most development and progression going on. I think if you ask most Israeli Jews, you know, and that is, Israeli Jewish community is largely bifurcated between the religious world and the secular world. There's it's a continuum too, but, you know, you have particularly the ultra-Orthodox, and, you know, you can set them up against the highly secularized community. You know, the secular folks aren't going to care about Jewish rituals, right? And the ultra-Orthodox are going to say, you know, that's abhorrent. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I think to some extent the American Jewish community, which is a little bit more towards the center for various reasons, one of them being that, you know, America is a pretty religious country. You know, you look at America versus Europe, you know, a lot more folks go to church here on Sundays. And I think that that kind of filters into the Jewish community too, and also that Judaism creates a sense of identity that's natural to being in Israel, right? You have that sense of Jewish identity just by virtue of the fact that you're living in Israel, you know, lingua franca is Hebrew and so on, right? In order to get that in America, there are other ways in which we have to create that, and one way is to incorporate some of these rituals into our lives. So, you know, some of the more innovative ritual pieces in the contemporary Jewish community are coming out of America and not out of Israel.
The final chapter in your volume is entitled How to Use This Book to Teach Undergraduates. And I was wondering what inspired you and your co-author on the chapter, Catherine Baker, to have a discussion of pedagogy and what might otherwise be seen as a fairly focused text on a fairly focused subject. I mean, it was an interesting thing to encounter at the end. And I'm also wondering if you've had an opportunity to actually use this text or earlier versions of the text in any classes that you've taught.
So let me answer second part first.
Okay.
So, the book just came out, so I haven't yet had the chance to do that. I think that this book could be, say, the focus of a writing seminar, right? And that's kind of what we talk about in the article, that there are ways in which the book is laid out to discuss a number of different periods in Jewish history. And so you could lay it up against a general Jewish history book, Ray Shinlin's Short History of the Jewish People, Paul Johnson's History of the Jews, and so on. And, look how in each period, the context that's described by Paul Johnson or Ray Shinlin, plays out in this one particular piece of Jewish life.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't had the chance to do that yet. I think it could happen at some point in the future. But, a book like this, I think, could have some popular appeal because folks love dogs. So folks who love dogs might be interested in this book. I know that my vet was very interested in it when I saw him earlier this week. And Jews are, I think, should be interested in this book because of what it says about what it means to be a Jew throughout history, about how Judaism, as I said before, is so highly shaped by its context, and get us thinking about ways in which the American context has shaped contemporary Jewish life. To that end, imagine that some undergraduate faculty would be excited about the book, maybe for personal reasons, and they might be asking themselves, how can I actually use this book? How can I use this focused text in my courses?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, if we think about what we do as scholars, much of the time we end up writing very narrow studies. My current project involves, Jewish urbanization in Iraq in the 8th century, right? Not something that keeps most people up at night, right? So, when you ask yourself, how are you going to use, this monograph that I've written? I've spent all these years on this one narrow question, right? How can I make this interesting and appealing? And then, of course, how can I make it interesting and appealing, not just for one lecture or two lectures or a piece of a course, but how can I make this kind of the backbone of a course? Students choose, undergraduate courses for a variety of reasons. One reason is because it fulfills certain requirements. Another reason is if it meets at a certain time
of
day.
A
certain day of the week. It's not Friday, right, exactly. But, I think that if one were to organize a course around the idea of the dog, the image of the dog throughout Jewish history, students might say, I have a dog, or I love dogs, or this is kind of interesting. And, it opens up a dialogue with the student because there's something that they can connect to, and you use it as a vehicle for teaching Jewish history and the questions of Jewish studies. And so that article that Kat Baker and I wrote is designed to kind of help provide that bridge, to help faculty kind of shape their courses around the book. So even though they or their students might just have a kind of personal casual interest in the subject, they can see it as a serious way of engaging Jewish history. Now, Kat, of course, worked at the Center for Teaching at Vanderbilt, where I was a fellow a couple years ago. And so, it was a great opportunity for me to explore pedagogy. And we go in the article pretty deeply into various techniques.
Right.
And there was an opportunity for me to bring kind of a Jewish aspect to teaching. Mm. So, there are some traditional models of Jewish teaching, question and answer, partner study, and so on, that I could bring to that article that allows the faculty member to kind of say, not only are we studying a Jewish topic, we're studying in a Jewish way.
Right.
Right. And so this, I think, kind of deepens the student's experience. And so hopefully, there are a number of points of connection, and hopefully that article will inspire some faculty to take it on and to adopt it for their courses.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thank you again for this conversation. It's been really interesting. And again, I've been talking with Phil Ackerman-Lieberman, Assistant Professor of Jewish Studies and Law, and Affiliated Assistant Professor of Islamic Studies, about the recent book, A Jew's Best Friend, The Image of the Dog Throughout Jewish History, which he edited with Rakefet Zalashik, and which was recently published by Sussex Academic Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and look for the link to send us an email. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.